Everyone, welcome to Computer Science E7. This is Lecture 7, More Software Tools. So one of the things that we released today were the guidelines for the final project. And basically, it's pretty simple what you have to do. The guidelines are basically to make one. And we do have some technical guidelines a little bit beyond that. And I'm sure that some of you, or many of you, or all of you will have questions about direction, like, well, what are some examples of some final projects that that I can do, and basically whatever you can think of where you are taking digital photos and can produce them digitally. So you have to take digital photos and then you manipulate them on your computer, and then you can basically do whatever you want with them after that. And some people prefer to have a collection of photos. Some people prefer to do something web-based, like a gallery, for example, an online gallery of images. And there's a variety of things, and I'll be showing you some examples. But just to give you an idea, you'll be submitting one or more digital photos for the completion of this final project. And if it's just one photo, it has to be something that you put a lot of work into. You can't just go outside, take a photo, say, that's it for E7, submit it, and be done. That will not be very good. Just to give you an idea, the amount of work that you put into this final project should be approximately equal to maybe two assignments in terms of the photos that you're taking, in terms of the time for the photos that you are taking and the time that you're using to actually work on them and manipulate them. And so just actually taking photos is one thing, and that's one of the things that we've been focusing on primarily in a lot of the first assignments, is just taking photos and submitting them as they are. But in the final project, you can manipulate them however you want digitally, and that includes Photoshop manipulation, enhancing the contrast, cropping, doing all sorts of really wild and crazy things that you want to do with them to achieve a goal for the final project. Remember that this class bills itself as teaching the technical side so that you can really let the creative juices flow elsewhere, so that you will be able to know or be able to understand how to operate a camera, and then by knowing how to do that, you can then let your artistic vision come to fruition, and that is what this final project is meant to do. So if you submit photos, and generally speaking, for pretty much anything that you do, you will need to submit at least one JPEG format photo to the Flickr photo stream. So just keep that in mind. But the end result can be a variety of different formats, like a book, for example, or a movie. It really depends on what you want to do, poster-sized image. So you can take photos in the raw formats, and in fact, I recommend that because, as we'll see today and in some future lectures, you have a lot more latitude over raw data than you do over just simply JPEG files. So I recommend taking photos in raw, but you must submit them in JPEG. So basically, in addition to that, you just have to write just a very quick, I call it a paper, but it's just a page or two, really short, about how you created the photo, what your motivation was, a variety of things, and there's some more information about that. So the first thing to keep in mind is that the proposal, you will have to create a proposal just so that we can vet your idea and make sure that it will be of enough consequence, perhaps, I could say. And then you will send that proposal to us at an email address, proposal@csc7.org, by November 23rd. So you really have just under a month to think of some ideas, get some more of the tools and some of the more of the lectures underneath your belt before you try to decide what is possible and what you might want to do with your particular image or images. And of course, if you want to send us email about questions or anything like that, we welcome that, and you're free to do that. There's more information on the proposal, which is available also in PDF format online. There's more information on that itself, and I'll have to defer to that. So one of the things that you'll notice is missing from this proposal are actually the steps to submit your final project. So we have to work out some details on our end for that, and that information will be available by the time your proposals are due at the end of November. And that shouldn't really matter, because none of you should be submitting final projects a month before the class is over anyway. So if you have any questions about that, do let us know. And of course, the culmination of the course, we end with a computer science fair, a joint fair between us and Computer Science E75, Building Dynamic Websites, taught by David Malin just downstairs, going on right this very minute, in fact. And whereas they design websites, we design images. And last year, we did this in the spring semester, and it was actually really, really interesting to see what everybody had submitted in both classes. And I have to say that I thought the E7 projects were quite a bit better than the E75. And if you happen to be in both classes, then, well, now you know which one you have to work harder on. So just to give you an idea, we have done a final project in the past couple of semesters for this course, and we do have some interesting things that I thought I might share with you. So as an example, I mentioned that you can decide to submit not only just a portfolio of images if you want, or even a poster-sized image, but you could do something web-based. And just because I'm showing you this doesn't mean that you have to do something web-based or you have to do a movie or something like that. It really is whatever you have the inclination to do. So here is one by a student a year ago, or a year and a half ago rather, where he took photos of people's faces, and then using a web page, you can recombine different faces by using some of these arrow keys. So you can choose somebody's eyes, somebody else's nose, and somebody else's mouth, and get some really strange, really fun looking photographs. And sometimes they blend surprisingly well, and sometimes, well, they don't blend that well, just depending on the photos. But those were, I think, that was a very good display of not only of the images itself, but also the display. So then we have a student who actually rented some equipment. She didn't have all of the equipment that she thought would be necessary to complete a final project. So she went to, I might have mentioned this before, but Calumet, and you can rent some big expensive lenses if you don't actually want to have to buy them, and basically covered the Boston Marathon. So E7 used to be a spring course before this semester, and so she covered the Boston Marathon and in sort of a photojournalistic style, and submitted a variety of photographs from that event. And that was something that was particularly interesting, I thought. Let's see, what else do I have here? Yes, so we did have one submission that was where a student had compiled a number of panoramas, and she submitted several of them, but I think I'll just show you this one, which I think is particularly interesting because because it is actually of a martial arts center of some kind. I forget exactly the name, but what was striking to me was that it's completely continuous. In other words, there's motion going on throughout the image, but it all blends seamlessly. Typically, when you take a diorama with images in them, or a panorama rather, with images in them, or with movement in them, what you see between the stitched images is sort of this ghost-like effect of where motion had taken place or should have taken place and is no longer there. But I remember looking at this image pretty intently and not really being able to find those seams. And I thought that was particularly well done as well. Let's see. So, I mean, there's so many good ones to show you. It would take me a long, long time to do it. So one student from a couple of years ago actually did a flipbook style animation. So she also submitted a movie online, or basically a digital movie of a flipbook style. And it's actually really neat, I think, to be able to flip through the animation. I'll actually go ahead and pass this around. Ignore the coffee stain on the top. That was my accident. And I think that was also something that was really neat, something that we haven't seen very much of lately. I think they were in vogue certainly some number of years ago, and then not so much anymore. Another one is, for example, this storefronts of Boston, where this is again a web page, but I think even if we just look at the images by themselves, it's very interesting to try to take a look at the style, the composition, and the end result of some of these images, how they actually came out. And I think this was also really quite good. Let's see, do I have another one? Oh yes, so here's one where I believe in software, a student wanted to replicate the look of tilt shift lenses. So in other words, to make real life images look like very small macro shots by increasing the depth of field. So not only did he have to get quite a bit of elevation in order to capture an image like this, but he also had to then work out how to accomplish this in software. Let's see, I think I have a few more I can show you. So just to prove to you that I think that having a portfolio of images is just as valid as any of these other types, one student covered a, oh man, I'm blanking. This was the big boat race that occurred in May or June of this year. It must have been April or May of this year. He actually covered that event, as this was something, there it is, the Volvo Ocean Race of 2009, as this was something that he was particularly interested in at the time as well. There's a really neat shot in here somewhere, but I don't want to waste too much of our time looking at this stuff. Oh yeah, so some very good, excellent images in this collection here. Let's see. Of course, some people went for the more abstract and wanted something that was a little bit scarier, maybe a little bit crazier than just these sort of ordinary, so to speak, images that we would see, rather ordinary in the sense of everyday things. So we might have a sort of a freaky dollhouse sort of scenario, or let's see, where's... Oops, not this one. Or we might also have, for example, come on, mermaid. Okay. Let's see, I think I might have one more. Oh yeah, so last one I'll show you for now is this one by a student who decided to, there was some local history that he really wanted to cover, and this was specifically the route of the old trolley 29 that I believe went through Arlington and possibly Lexington. And yes, we have to wait forever for it to load the preview. It's this very large, ended up being this very large PowerPoint presentation full of not only information but also images, of course, about the actual route itself. So he actually followed along the route and use that as an opportunity to sort of highlight interesting aspects of that particular route. And so I'm showing you all of these as just examples of what you might be able to accomplish with your final project. So really, it's meant to be something that you can call your own and make it personal to you. And if you can do that, then it's something that you'll also be very successful at, because something that you're passionate about will reflect in your images and in your work. And so that's this is one of the things. This is really, I think, an excellent example of what this class aims to be, is that once you've learned all of this stuff, then you can apply it. And as you can see, all of these photos have been really excellent. They've been really very good examples of what students are able to accomplish by the time this class is over. So that's a little bit of an advertisement for this course, which you are, of course, already taking, so it's perhaps not totally necessary, but also meant to just give you an idea about what we can do. So today we're going to focus on the software tools, how you can accomplish some of the things that you saw. For example, that really stylized mermaid effect that you saw. Maybe we're not going to go into how to do that specifically, but introduce some of these tools that will help you be able to do them. One of them, of course, is Photoshop. So being able to use Photoshop to manipulate images, edit them, is important to us as digital photographers, to be able to stylize your photos how you may want them, unless your goal is to have very representative, very neutral images that represent the original scene in the most accurate way possible. But even beyond that, you might still use Photoshop if you take photos in the RAW format, for example, these photos are not a format that you can just upload to Flickr or to your friend over email and be able to expect them to really look at the image, because it's a proprietary image format. It's difficult for us to view them, and converting them to JPEG makes it a lot more portable and a lot easier for us to be able to view. And so using Photoshop, we can certainly do that. Now, one of the things about this course that you may notice is that we do place a large emphasis on the technical aspect. And so as a result of that, we also sometimes talk a lot about the equipment itself, and we start getting all wide-eyed and really impressed by some of the specifications, some of the text that we can read about equipment on paper. And this may not be, I don't want you to get the wrong idea. That's not necessarily the best way to approach photography. And really one of the most important things about photography, of course, is the photographers, the person actually using the camera. But the equipment is really just a means to an end. And having, there reaches a point where, sure, you might spend quite a bit of money to buy an SLR and maybe some lenses and some nice equipment, but there reaches a point where in order to get incrementally better equipment, you have to spend a lot more money. And that certainly happens at the higher end of a lot of this equipment. So I don't want you to get the wrong idea that you absolutely have to have the most expensive equipment, the best equipment that exists out there today, because you might find yourself with all of this expensive equipment and not the will to use it all of the time. It's really something that you have to gauge for yourself. And in fact, one of the pitfalls of using new equipment all of the time is if you purchase a new camera and you take photos with this camera, this is the new shiny camera on the block, it's just released and everybody's all excited about it. You take a bunch of photos in raw format because that's what you do, and you try to open it in Photoshop, and you might see something like this. Try to open the raw file and it says, could not complete your request because Photoshop does not recognize this type of file. And this is really, really frustrating. And in fact, this is the exact scenario that has just happened to me, though I admittedly knew that this was going to happen. This is something that we have to try to combat. And unfortunately, because these file formats are proprietary and they're tied to specific cameras, they're tied to specific camera manufacturers, it's not the quickest process. So this third-party software like Photoshop, like Lightroom, like Apple Aperture, cannot open the raw files the first few months, the first few weeks, the first few months that a camera is out. So if you buy a shiny new camera, you might run into this sort of problem. And if that happens, you'll have to eventually update the raw software, the raw engine that can interpret these files. Now for Photoshop, I'm showing you Adobe's website that allows us to download what's called the Camera Raw Update. And it is this update that allows us to get the latest and greatest essentially add-on, you can think of it as, to Photoshop to be able to open these raw files. And you can find this just literally by Googling around for Adobe Camera Raw or a variety of other things that have, you know, Photoshop and Camera Raw in them. But you'll notice yet another pitfall about this. Let's see. Where is it? Oh, no. All right, so here we go. This small bit of text down here, and I'll make the text bigger so we can see it. Maybe I can. Okay, we have to continue waiting for my pitifully slow computer. Okay, here we go. So it says, support for the following cameras is included in Camera Raw 5 and Lightroom 2. Camera Raw 5 and later is not compatible with Photoshop CS3. Now, if you're familiar with Photoshop, you know that CS4 is the latest and greatest version. And you might also know that Photoshop is, you know, very expensive piece of software to begin with. And so for them to stop support for CS3, which is just one version old, is bad for us. So we're not going to talk about anything like how this is bad for the consumer and try to push Adobe and to do the right thing or that sort of thing. But this is actually a problem for us, is that to use the latest and greatest, and if you do spend a bit more money to get the newest camera, you might find that you also have to upgrade some other things like this software as well. Luckily, all of you as students at the Extension School get a bit of a freebie. You can download Adobe, the latest version of Photoshop, and be able to download this latest camera, RAW 5. So unless you have pretty much the newest cameras that were released in the past few months, you will be able to use your camera with it. And now, of course, I should mention that older cameras, cameras that are more than several months old, are very well supported across different versions. So this really, you really don't have to spend money to upgrade or do anything like that unless you run into this problem that I'm describing. If it works in another version, then by all means, use that. But you can actually download Photoshop from FAS. And so this has been looking up downloads.fas.harvard.edu since I started blabbing about 25 minutes ago. So this is not going to work right now. But if you go to, downloads.fas.harvard.edu, you can download the Adobe Photoshop software. Now, I have to mention that you do need some other software as well. And the reason that I'm telling you all of this is so that you can download this software onto your computer if you don't have it already, because coming soon, you will start to need to use Photoshop for your assignments. So I'm trying to help you get a head start with this. So after you go here, you log in with your Harvard ID, and you get past this screen that isn't working for me. Let's see, I'll try clicking there again. Oh, good. So hopefully this time it'll work. Now it'll present you with a variety of things that you can download. You need two, maybe three things in order for this to work. First of all, of course, is Photoshop itself. So, man, really? Got to do this again? All right, I'm going to cheat, and I'm going to use my my little password saver thing. Yeah, it's also because it's really long, my password for this. Okay, so after we wait for a few seconds, you'll see a list of downloads, and you could actually go crazy and download it, you know, as much stuff as you want, but we're not going to deal with all the other stuff. We really want Photoshop, which is under P here. Yep. All right, so you can download it here. You'll notice that it's actually quite large. It's about a gigabyte in size. So you might need to, if you have a slow connection, you might need to wait quite a while. Of course, you should make sure that you download it for your the correct version of your operating system, be it Windows or Mac OS. Yes? Major differences between CS3 and CS4? I don't actually know. I stopped paying attention to the differences between Photoshop versions a while ago, frankly. I think the changes recently have been more incremental, so more, and to quote what is fast becoming an internet cliche, more evolutionary rather than revolutionary. So right now, I have to admit, I do have an older version of Photoshop installed, CS3, and that's one of the reasons why you saw that error message, was because I don't have the latest version of Camera Raw. But the fundamental differences between Photoshop CS4 that you can download here and CS3, which I have installed on my computer, it's not very major. There might be some minor things. There might be some new filters, some new features, but it's not really going to be a deal breaker in terms of your use. So you can really use any of these modern CS and then some number version of Photoshop. In fact, I have an ancient CS1 version on my computer at home because I haven't wanted to pay for Photoshop since. Yes? Good. Yes, so that brings me to my next point. So is this software the full version? And the answer is yes, but kind of. So there is a caveat to it. When you download it and you use it, it is the full uninhibited version. It's completely as if you were using the $700 Photoshop program. But the trick with this is this little word right here where it says keyed. Now, what this means is that Harvard has a fixed number of licenses available to it, and they can only allow their students, all of you, including me, that many. They can only allow that many students or people to use that that software at any one point in time. So, in addition to Photoshop, you also need something else that manages this this sort of counting, so to speak, and that is the key server. And it's, I know it's confusing, but you can find it at the bottom. But basically, before you even download Photoshop, I'd recommend downloading this key server, installing it on your computer, then you can try to install Photoshop. Except for one thing. This works great if you are on Harvard's campus, if you're using Harvard's internet. It doesn't work great if you are sitting at home. Now, the reason that Key Server works is because it knows you're on Harvard's internet, and it then authenticates you. It says, okay, you must be allowed to use Harvard's resources, and therefore it allows you to use Photoshop. So if you are off campus, in addition to these two things, you must also download the VPN client. This allows you to log into Harvard, which then allows the Key Server to communicate with whatever Key Server, wherever it is, and then you can open Photoshop. So if you're sitting at home, what I recommend is download the VPN client first, download the Key Server next. So what I mean is download and install. So you download the VPN client, download the Key Server, then you can download and install Photoshop. Okay, now that we've wasted a lot of time talking about that, then you can have it up and running. Was there a question?
Just quickly, so that means you can't use this software in offline mode at all. You have to be counted as a concurrent user of the software user.
I think the official answer is yes, but the unofficial answer is no. So I think it works if you, it only does, as far as I know, it only does, unless they've updated it, it only does the Key Server authentication when it starts up the program, and then I believe you can go offline, potentially. Right, so as long as you keep Photoshop running, it will continue running. Yes?
Which is rude to your fellow students, because there are only so many licenses, so
right. Right, yeah, and so like I said, yeah, exactly. So just to repeat, because there are a fixed number of licenses, if you keep it open all the time, then you're possibly disallowing somebody else to use that particular license. Yes?
One more question. Unless something has changed drastically in the last couple of months, in order to run VPN client, you have to have an email address at fas.harvard.edu, mm-hmm. which any of us can get, but you have to know that you need to go and apply for your FAS you never ever have to use for email. You just need to actually have one in order for the VPN clients to work so you can log in.
Yeah, that is a very good point. So I'll just repeat again for the camera. So to use the VPN client, you have to have an @FAS email address, which means that you just have to apply for one. It's online and you don't actually have to use it for anything. But once you have it, and you have to be registered for this course to get it, it's getting complicated. But you can see that. If you have questions, you can email us. You can, I'm sure John will talk about it briefly, hopefully in section. I just, I'm forcing him to do it now, right? So it would be a good activity for section. But you can see, it's nice once you have all of this done, because you open up Photoshop and you see it says some message about the Key Server is running or something like that, and it opens up and it's a big sigh of relief. But that's just one hurdle, because then you have to deal with Photoshop itself, right? So that's sort of the next thing. Was there a question somewhere else? Yes.
What about simpler versions, like Photoshop Elements, things like that?
What about them?
Will those work just fine, or is that something you hear straight away from for any
reason? So simpler versions of Photoshop like Elements, I don't actually know what the functional differences are offhand between Elements and Photoshop. I'm talking about Photoshop here because it's sort of the de facto standard, and so I don't want to introduce this other software that's not lesser, but maybe more introductory in terms of its features than the full featured Photoshop. But if that's what you have, then you're free to use it. When I'm talking about software manipulation, you can use anything that you want. There's free versions, not free versions of Photoshop, but there's free alternatives to Photoshop. Like I believe there's one called the unfortunately named GIMP software, and you can download that for free. And that's I haven't used that, but I know that that's a free alternative as well. But I mean, as you can see, there's a lot of nuances here and all of this stuff. But what I'm talking about is, for the purposes of this class, we're using Photoshop, but you're free to use whatever software manipulation photo manipulation software that you would like. Okay, any other questions before we move on? All right, great. So now let's say that you have actually taken a photo in the raw file type with your camera. And one of the things that you want to do is to be able to process it. So before, up until this point, I'd always talked about using some software to process, let's see, I'm trying to find a specific one, using some software to process the raw files. And so this is actually what I am talking about, is using Photoshop. What is going on with this thing? Okay, are you serious? Now what? Okay, I'm gonna try one more time. And I know this one works because this is from my ancient 5-year-old 20D. So once this loads up, then hopefully we will see. Okay, so now I've taken a photo in the raw format with my camera. I have opened up Photoshop and I have dragged that photo into Photoshop, or I've tried to open it up. And so one of the things that happens first when you have a raw file, now notice that this same screen will not appear if you just open up a JPEG with Photoshop. Anything that is not a raw file format will not open up with this window. This only opens up because it is a raw file format. Now we have a variety of things that we can manipulate in this image. And I'd always talked about using software to process a raw image, and this is sort of the beginning steps of what I am talking about. At the simplest, to process a raw file, you open it up in software like Photoshop, and then you just leave everything alone. You don't touch any of these messy sliders or anything like that. Just click Open Image, and after a few seconds, what you will get, unless you have my really slow computer and it's a few minutes, what you will get is a file that has been converted from the raw file type into a more friendly file type. So this here, where I can then manipulate it in Photoshop or just save it as a particular JPEG. So actually, if you will allow me, I'm going to do one thing to make this easier so I don't have to keep switching things back and forth. Now, doing this at its simplest, where you're just opening a raw file and you are processing it and then you are saving it as a JPEG, this is very easy to do because it only takes a couple of clicks, but I argue that this is sort of counter to the point of the raw file type, because what you are not doing is you're not using that raw file to the degree that you are allowed to. So I'm not saying that you have to always manipulate an image, but if you find yourself doing this more often than not, and what I mean by this is opening a raw file and just processing it as with all the default options, then you might as well just take photos in JPEG. There's really not a reason for you to use raw unless you're going to be doing some sort of manipulation with them. Okay, so with that out of the way, what I'm going to do is close this and try reopening it. 4199, drag this back here. And after a few minutes, I get this window back. Okay, so what I wanted to talk about today, at least in this first half, was some of these options that are available to us here. So you can do a lot of things in this camera raw, this add-on that exists in Photoshop. And so some of the most obvious things are over here on the right side. So for example, you can adjust the color temperature. So let's say that the color is slightly askew. So for whatever reason, let's say, oh, I don't remember this sunset actually being red. Maybe I want it to be a little bit cooler. Then you could adjust the temperature as necessary. Now, of course, you can do a lot of these modifications to JPEG files as well, but you will find that with RAW files, you will be able to do these conversions at the highest quality and also more easily than you could in JPEG format. So, because essentially what you are doing is you are using the data, the RAW data, that as it comes off of the camera sensor. It saves it into this very large file. You're opening it in Photoshop and you're able to manipulate that RAW data as it exists. Now, one of the things that you'll notice before I delve even deeper into it is that we have a histogram in the upper right-hand corner showing us basically the histogram of this particular image. Now, okay, so I just wanted to get that out of the way to tie it into the lecture that we had last week. Now, one of the things that you'll notice that a lot of these raw processors has is preset white balance settings. So you can change it from the default, the as shot, which is what the camera decided the white balance would be. Don't worry, we'll talk about more about what white balance is at a later point in time when it gets to the color lecture. Or you could try to have Photoshop pick a white balance automatically, or you can use one of these presets to try to pick the appropriate color temperature. And this may or may not be appropriate based on the particular type of image that you have. Now, one of the interesting things about almost all white balance, or rather all raw processors, is the ability to pick a color in the image and use that as sort of the white balance. So you could say that, so as you can see, I've clicked on this eyedropper tool in the upper left-hand corner, this white balance tool, as it's called, and I'll zoom in a little bit so you can see this one up here. And what this lets me do is I can select a particular point in the image that's either white or very close to it, or maybe some form of gray, to be able to pick the correct color balance. And that's going to be difficult in this particular image. There's not a lot of strictly white portions of the image. But just to give you an example of what sort of drastic changes we can do, I'll try to click on this red portion of the light over here. You can see that now it's trying to compensate for that by making it very, very blue and actually kind of ugly. All right, but changing it back to a somewhat more normal white balance. All right, now the other great thing about using the raw format is that the camera stores a lot more data in the raw file than you actually see. So this file that we see, or this image that we see right here, there's a certain amount of data to it, but there's actually more data stored inside of the raw file that allows us to manipulate certain things that we might have messed up before, such as the exposure. So let's say that you are pretty bad at taking a properly exposed shot. Well, you could use this exposure slider to try to correct the exposure. Now, one of the nice things about this is that you can actually recover quite a few details back from the image while using this exposure slider, even if it's slightly, and I mean slightly, overexposed. I've been talking a lot about if you overexpose something, that's it, you can't recover that data. That was somewhat of a lie, because with RAW, you can recover some amount of data, but I really wasn't kidding. There's a certain point where there's just no more data, and there's just nothing that you're going to do. By pulling this exposure slider back, if you really have overexposed some particular image, you're just going to make that patch of overexposure darker. You're not actually going to be recovering data. But we do get some additional latitude here. So one of the things that was noticeable to me, and I'll zoom in just a little bit to try to make it more apparent for you, was in this section of clouds up here. So when I had the exposure set to about the default, so at about zero in terms of a relative number of stops from the exposure as it was, you can see that there's some details that are potentially missing from the clouds. But if I try to pull it down, then we sort of recover some of the details, particularly these little wisps of clouds that are off to the side that just were not particularly visible before. Now, this doesn't mean that you should always use this slider, because obviously I've now made this particular image horribly underexposed, but the option is there using this slider. So sometimes you might get some other, all right, let's try default. So you might get some other sliders as well, depending on the raw processor that you're using. Sometimes you'll get something that Photoshop calls recovery, but if we click on this, one of the things you'll notice is that what this is doing is, well, it might be tough to tell in this particular image, but almost all raw processors have a similar thing where it tries to bring overexposed regions down to a better exposure level. So if you have certain regions of the photo that are slightly overexposed and you need to try to recover details in them, you can use this recovery slider to try to regain those details that you might have lost. And again, if you're using other raw processors, it might be called something else. Now, fill light does sort of the opposite. That is, if you have lost details in the darker regions of your photo, you can try to use something like this fill light to try to bring in additional light into those darker regions. And you'll notice that, did it actually make a difference? It looks different on my screen here, but. All right, so now I've been able to recover actually some, you can see some power line posts, some mountains, and other nouns that I apparently can't think of right now. So anyway, you can use this, and of course, when I'm showing you these things, you should use them in moderation. You should not be using these sliders to the extreme that I'm showing you. That usually indicates that you just didn't take the photo very well to begin with, or that if it really needs something with that much modification, you might need to go back and try to reshoot it. But it does allow you a little bit of latitude so that you can try to recover a little bit of details and try to get quite a bit of information back. Was there a question? Yes. I'm sorry, can you speak up just a tad? So the reason that you get these sort of artifacts around the regions that have been enhanced using these sliders, so using recovery to bring down highlights or fill light to bring up some dark regions, you might get some weird halo-like effects around the regions that have been most greatly affected by it. And that has to do with basically what's called the tone curve of the image. And basically what we're doing when we're modifying these sliders is that we're changing something called the tone curve of the image to alter how it appears to us. And so I don't want to go into too much about this because we will, of course, at a later point in time. But basically by somehow manipulating this tone curve, if I can manipulate it, you will see that you can actually... all right, so let's say that I've adjusted this highlight slider under the tone curve section. So I clicked on tone curve here and just adjusted the highlights. You'll notice that whereas before the tone curve was this sort of straight line, which is misleading because the tone curve is actually not a straight line, we've now introduced this sort of additional bump in there. That means essentially that we are over-representing the brightness of some pixels relative to other pixels. And so we can get weird effects because we're essentially, you can think of it as kind of stretching the brightness of a particular range of images. And so you can get some weird effects within that region that's overly stretched. And so without going into a large discussion about what the tone curve is and talking about it for an hour, that's really sort of the best answer I can give for right now. And so I'll have to, I guess, defer a better answer to when we actually talk more about this at a later point in time. Okay, so going back to these sliders, one of the things that you can do, so I mentioned how you can fix some of the problems in your image, but sometimes you might have taken a pretty good image and all you really want to do is to just somehow make it a bit better. So rather than manipulate the recovery or the fill light, and it's unfortunate because this projector over saturates and makes everything a little bit more contrasty than it appears otherwise. One of the things that we might want to do is actually to increase the contrast so that we can get maybe a little bit more punch into that image. Another thing we might do is actually increase the saturation, not too much, increase the saturation and get just a little bit more color into it as well. And so rest assured that this is starting to look cartoonish in colors on the screen, but on this computer it looks starting to look fantastic. So I'm doing this for myself, not for you, right? Okay, so now I can even increase the vibrance, which is related to the saturation, but it seems to increase local contrast, perhaps. So this is difficult to quantify, but really you can increase these sliders and try to get the exact amount of punch that you want to get in a particular image. Now, one of the things that I do want to point out is, oh no, that's not what I wanted to point out, is this information that exists at the bottom of this camera raw window. So you'll see that at the very bottom, underneath the image name, it gives me some information. It says Adobe RGB, 16-bit, and then the size. So it's an 8-megapixel image at 240 pixels per inch. And so I should mention that the pixels per inch doesn't really impact how this image will appear on your screen. Modifying the pixels per inch really only matters when you're going to print your image. And generally, you want somewhat high pixels per inch for a print that's going to be where you're going to view up close, so maybe like a 4x6 image or a 5x7, for example. But if you're going to be printing it on something much larger that's to be viewed farther away, like on a billboard, for example, then you could get away with a much lower pixels per inch. But I'm just mentioning this because I think sometimes there's a bit of confusion about exactly what this can do. Don't worry about it if you're not going to be modifying this, or if you're not going to be printing this information, or this photo, rather. So if I click on this this little bit of text that exists at the bottom, I can actually modify this particular image. And so you remember now when I was telling you that every color channel has, in a JPEG file, 8 bits of information or 256 different values available to it. Now that gave us quite a bit of values, of different color values within one particular image. However, that's not always good enough, especially when we're about to modify an image. So if you're going to do a lot of modification to an image, I recommend that you don't use 8 bits per channel, but instead use 16 bits per channel. So if you're about to do further modifications to this in Photoshop beyond what you're doing in Camera Raw, then you might want to use 16 bits per channel. On the other hand, if you're just going to open the image as it is, save it as a JPEG, then you might as well just make this an 8-bit per channel image. If you're in doubt, just always use 16 bits per channel, and then when you save it as a JPEG, it will be downsampled to 8 bits, to the amount that we have discussed up until this point. And from here, you can also decrease the size of the image as well. So Photoshop gives us some pretty easy ways of making the image smaller, or for whatever reason, making it a lot bigger, which, as you know, is just going to be a digital zoom of sorts, and we won't actually get any additional information. It's just going to be bigger. All right, now Adobe RGB, I'm going to argue, you shouldn't actually use. You should pretty much always use sRGB. Keep that in mind, because that'll be a question later. All right, then we'll just open this image. And so that's really how we can process this raw file, sort of in a nutshell. Now, one of the other things that can happen to you, so if you're to run into this situation where you try to open a new photo in Photoshop and you get this error, cannot complete your request because Photoshop does not recognize this type of file, this usually means that you're going to be stuck with the first party software that comes with your camera for a little while. So just because I get this message, it doesn't mean that I can't do anything with these raw photos. I can actually use the software that came with the camera. In this case, it depends on which type of camera you have, but if you have a Canon, then it's going to be called Digital Photo Professional, and if you have a Nikon, it's called something NX or FX or something. I have no idea. But anyway, I forget exactly. So you can use that software to open it up, but one of the other things about using this first-party software is that you can also usually connect to the camera directly and be able to get sort of a live view of what's going on. And I apologize that this looks absolutely terrible, but I blame it on this crappy pane of glass that exists over here that I'm pointing the camera through right now. Otherwise, if I were to point it at, say, the very fancy clock that we have up here, let's see, is this going to, I have to do this. All right, let's see, here's the clock. All right, that's a bit better. Now you can watch your lives ticking away as I blab about this. Okay, so now you're saying, oh, it's almost time for the 5-minute break. But really, what this allows you to do is you can have a live view of the image that you are about to take. And this is particularly useful for studio setup. So if you're going to take some product shots, or if you're going to take some shots in your home, you can connect the camera using a USB cable to your computer and try to get this sort of live view of a particular image. You can usually control the camera directly from your computer. So I can try a test shooting. Nope. All right, so it just took a, you might have just heard a small click, and so it's just taking a image, if it's ever going to show up. So that's the downside to having a new camera, is that it has too many megapixels, and then it makes your computer slow, and you get this fancy spinning pinwheel of death. All right, so we have immortalized the time. Is that right? Oh, yeah, it is. Okay, 6:22 p.m. All right, now I'm just showing you this because these tools do exist, not only in first party, but also to a degree in third party as well, where you can connect it and be able to use Lightroom or Aperture or I believe there's some software called Capture One where you can connect to the camera and be able to modify the settings. And in fact, you can see all the settings that are available here. I'm running an aperture of f4.5 with an ISO of 100. And it's going to take a photo in the raw format. And I have an exposure compensation of about plus one-third stop, or I could actually modify that in my particular camera. And also because I'm, not plus five. Oh, man. Oh, no, not minus five. All right, well, all right, you're getting the idea. And all of this live view is making the battery go completely to waste, so I will close this. All right, now the point of this, again, is just to show you that if you were taking photos indoors or somewhere where you have a controlled amount of light, then this can be a very, very good way of being able to preview the photos that you are about to take. Another really good way, if you perhaps don't have a computer where you can move it to where you're about to take the photos, for example, maybe you're taking photos in your living room, for example, and you have a TV there. Many times you can connect the camera to a TV instead and be able to get a view of the images as you shoot them, or even this sort of live view where you can actually see the images as you're about to take them there as well. Okay, now, let's see. So all of this software is really meant to be able to capture these photos, manipulate them some way, and then be able to publish them on the internet or print them out or do any sort of manipulation like that. So if I have an image, and I'm going to have to, I guess I'll open this one instead, 4189. Oh, come on. No, you know what, I'll do 74. So now let's say that you have taken an image, and one of the things that you notice is that it's, you kind of like the image, but there's something really annoying, like a power line that runs through it or some other problem that exists with it, you might realize that this is what Photoshop is designed to do. It's designed to help you try to eliminate problems such as that. So if we just process this image, one of the things that we might want to do is somehow manipulate this image. And one of the most obvious ways we can do it is to actually is to remove that power line somehow, but perhaps one of the less obvious ways that we can do it is to modify some of this this data or some of this information that we could have modified in Camera Raw, but we will use another tool instead, and that is to use, let's say, levels or curves. And so I'm showing you these tools because you can use these to manipulate quite a bit of information in the photograph and change how it appears quite a drastic amount. And so using levels, you will see a histogram for your particular image. And you can see that we get to pick which channel we want to modify the levels for. In this case, I want to modify all three channels, red, green, and blue. And I have some sliders underneath where if I change the sliders somehow, you can see that it's making some sort of modification to that particular image. So really quickly, just to introduce this levels tool to you, when you see this this histogram, you should know that it's representative of the photo itself. Now, you might remember that this far left section represents the shadows region, so you know how much of this region is actually really quite dark. The opposite end is how much is really quite bright. But you might also realize that there's a bit of a gap between the absolute dark region and where the bulk of our dark pixels actually are. What we can do is modify this histogram to try to make all of those pixels actually black. So now if you notice, if you pay attention in particular to, if you look everywhere in the photo, as I modify this slider, you see that things seem to be getting a little bit darker. But what is actually happening is that you are making this point. So what used to be this area right here in the histogram, by sliding this black point slider over, you're making this the new black, so to speak. You're making it the value zero in the end result. So this, which used to be this value 32 right here, is now a value zero. So you can imagine that now what you are doing is something that used to be actually quite light, and again, I apologize for the over-contrastiness of this particular projector, but something that actually used to be quite light, where you can actually see the details on this particular mountain, including the lack of flora that actually exists in this desert mountain, you can actually make it a silhouette proper by moving this black slider over and allowing that particular portion of the image to become a true black within the particular image. Now, likewise, I could do the same thing on this end to manipulate what represents white. So right here, I do have a bit of a spike representing some overexposed pixels, which are most likely the very top area of pixels where there's some sunlight sort of peeping through the clouds. But if I want to try to make that region a little bit brighter, I can move this over as well, which allows more pixels to become white. So rather than these pixels being slightly less than white, they were just ever so slightly darker than white, we are now, by smoothing the slider over, making them white. So what that means is that we have essentially increased the contrast in this particular image, but we have done it in such a way that we get to define exactly what is black and exactly what is white. So you have a finer grain control over modifying the contrast using a tool like this levels tool, rather than just using a sort of dumb slider where you can just increase the contrast and you just have to eyeball it. Rather than here, you actually get to define this as being a silhouette and the very top region as being this white area. And so with this in mind, you can modify these other sliders. Just realize that what you were doing is saying that, okay, these pixels that used to be a middle gray, used to be a value of 114, if I slide them upwards, then what is going to happen is that, okay, now these pixels that used to be brighter over here are now this new middle gray. So it makes the whole thing appear to be darker, if that makes sense. So we are modifying the contrast quite a bit. So before we had this sort of image, which was kind of neat, but it didn't show the texture in the clouds, and you could see too much texture in this mountain. Now we can actually exaggerate the texture in the clouds and just make the mountain a particular silhouette. And when we click OK, then we would be able to modify those particular pixels. Now the downside, of course, is that we get this obnoxious power line to be even more obnoxious. Okay, so let's take a 5-minute break, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about Photoshop. Okay, welcome back, everybody. So before the break, we were talking about using the levels tool to be able to modify, to have greater control over the contrast within an image. But there's also another tool as well that we can use to modify the contrast of an image, and that is the curves as well. So both of these tools are available under the image menu, adjustments, levels, or curves. And you could actually use like something like auto levels, auto contrast, auto color, but I recommend that you actually avoid those for the most part and do it manually, because almost all of the time you will get better results if you fine tune by yourself rather than use the auto tools. So the curves is sort of a similar idea. It's just a different way of presenting this same amount of information, though what happens in this case is that you have arguably even finer grain control over what happens to the surrounding bits of information from that black point, from that white point, and from that sort of middle gray. So if you recall that we had those three sliders, the black point was the one on the far left where you could adjust which is the black, and the other two correspond to whatever they sound like. So using curves, what we can do is actually modify, again, the contrast or even the brightness of a particular image. And you'll notice that we have basically a straight line, a straight diagonal line that goes from an input of black to an output of black all the way through an input of white to an output of white. So you'll notice that along these two axes, we have two different things, basically two pieces of information. So we have here the input, so basically the data as it's coming from the file. So whatever the file says is a value of 0, black is right here. Whatever it says is a value of 128, or about, you know, mid-range, is right here. Whatever is 256 is over there. And what the output refers to is what we're actually seeing on the screen. So in this case, this is something that's going to be completely black on the screen. This is something that's going to be a middle gray on the screen. And the very top is going to be something that's very white on the screen. And so if you modify this, let's say that we bump the curve up slightly, you'll notice that it makes things generally brighter. And that makes sense because now what used to be this middle gray right here is now up here. So right here, the input level, where the input used to be the sort of middle gray, in the file that actually says it's a middle gray, it mapped correspondingly to the output of being this middle gray. So what is actually displayed on the screen was a middle gray. But as soon as we bumped it up, then what happens is that this middle gray that used to be right here in the middle is now a little bit higher. So it is now some number of values higher than what it used to be. And in fact, we get to see exactly what it is. So what used to be a value of 115 is now a value of 151. So what used to be just slightly darker than middle gray is now slightly brighter than middle gray. And you can actually create multiple points. And so one of the best ways to increase the contrast is to bump up the highlights a little bit. So just something like this. You don't want to overdo it again, otherwise you'll get some really crazy colors. And then you can bring down the shadows a little bit. And having a more vertical line here means that this will be contrastier. You will get a little bit more contrast available within the image. And the reason for that is that what used to be, so this level of gray, this sort of, it's about a quarter of the way in, is now considerably darker. So what used to be dark is now darker. And what used to be bright is now brighter. So we're just increasing the apparent contrast within this particular image. And we could really go all out and crazy and really make the contrast really quite high. But you can see that this makes it really quite ugly. But what we've done is really increased the contrast. And in fact, we can look at this and think about what this is doing intelligently. So here we have all the way up until almost middle gray. All of this information is now being thrown away. We're calling it black now. And then all of this information in the middle is what is most important for all of this range of colors. And then very quickly up here, about a quarter of the way before absolute white, we are now saying that it is going to be this sort of pure white that exists within the image. So we get this very harsh, overly contrasted image within a particular or within this particular photo. Now, I realize that one of the downfalls to using this is that you could have actually modified this photo using those sliders in the Adobe Camera Raw or other raw formats or other raw software to actually increase the contrast if you really wanted it to look this cartoonish. However, using these tools brings us to something else that we get to do with Photoshop as well. In fact, so increasing the contrast, I do want to mention as an aside, if you increase it too much, something that didn't have a lot of noise could suddenly have a lot more noise within it. And it's sort of kind of hard to tell on the projector. And again, I apologize for that. But you can see, and particularly these sort of middle gray regions, where we now have a lot more noise within the image where previously we just had none. So that's another pitfall to using this. However, using the raw file type, because we had a lot more available data to us, we don't see a lot of other artifacts besides these sort of crazy colors and maybe enhanced noise. We would see some additional color artifacts as well if we try to do a similar thing in the JPEG file format. Now, keep all of this in mind, because I need to actually switch gears a little bit and talk about another portion of Photoshop before I can tie this in together again. So I want to direct your attention to the lower right-hand portion over here, or this little box over here that says layers at the top. And so those of you that have used Photoshop before are probably familiar with layers, the layer concept. But for those of you that aren't, just imagine that you have some particular layer like this background, for example, and it's just this white piece of paper. So it could be something like this, but imagine that it's all white, or not in this case, but let's say that I created a new file, just any old file here, and now you'll see that the layer for that, this background layer, is all white. And if I were to create some doodle on this particular layer, so I'll just do something crazy like this. All right, just anything, just to represent a doodle on there. Now you'll notice that it is as if I had drawn on this white sheet of paper. Okay, it's just like you would expect when you're actually modifying a particular image. You're actually modifying the pixels of that image. However, if I create an additional layer, and you'll notice that there's sort of a it looks like a new page, a folded over page icon. If I click that, I create a new layer on top, and you can think of this as essentially a piece of transparency or a piece of like cellophane that's now on top of this sheet of paper with the doodle. So now I can continue doodling on that layer. So I'll change the color of the brush here to a blue, or to a cyan, I guess. And then I'll just make some lines here to represent another doodle. Now, traditionally, you might think, okay, well, now I've actually just drawn over that black doodle. But because I've drawn it on a new layer, which if you think of, again, as a piece of transparency on top, that means that I can treat each of these independently of each other. So if I had these two sheets and I remove the first doodle, then I would see only that cyan sort of that cyan doodle that I created, and that's exactly what you see here. Or if I recreated that original image and then I moved that piece of transparency away, now what I would see is the original doodle that existed on that white sheet of paper. And so this is a relatively simple concept, but it is really important to us as Photoshoppers to be able to use these layers to their full effectiveness. Now, in order to show or hide a layer, you have to modify. You just click on this little eye icon that's next to the layer, and if you click on that, then it makes that one layer disappear. So I can click to show it or click to hide it, and this actually becomes very, very useful. And so, modifying these layers can actually be a pretty fun thing. So, in addition to just being able to create a new layer, you could also add some particular effects to one layer individually. So you'll notice that here I have a whole bunch of options available to me. And this is the sort of thing that's really fun to play with at home, and I'm not going to go into too much detail about it, but I could do, for example, a drop shadow on this top layer. And now, whereas before I just had these cyan lines, now I just have this sort of shadow 3D effect on it. So I can just very easily add some neat and useless effects to a particular layer. But this is great if you're into more digital painting than perhaps this photo manipulation, where these effects perhaps are not quite as useful. Okay, so to take another step towards tying these tools all together is that we can use a layer to be able to manipulate other layers underneath it. So as you can see, we've already sort of done that here by drawing these cyan lines on top of my black doodle. You can see that I've already altered, you know, how that black doodle appears. But let's say that I had something much more complex than just this doodle. Let's say that I had an image like this, where I only want to modify a specific portion of the image and not the entire thing. So whereas before, what we did when we were modifying the levels or the curves, we were modifying it for the entire image, we can now use layers to try to manipulate only a certain aspect of that image. And there is something special, a special type of layer. So here I'm just going to undo our fancy curves. Let's see, where's the history? Oh no, where did history go? Here it is, open. All right, so this is what our original image looked like. Now let's say that I just wanted to modify a specific region of the curves. Or to put it another way, what's even more important about this is that if you remember from having this layer concept, I could modify each layer independently. That means that when I modified this top layer, I didn't have to touch the bottom layer. I wasn't actually modifying the data that existed in that bottom layer. And that's really important when we want to be able to go back and make some further changes to maybe one of these other layers. As you manipulate these photos and as they become more complex, you really will want to go back and modify something a few steps earlier. So if we create a special type of layer called an adjustment layer, and by going to the layer menu, new adjustment layer, you see that we have a lot of the same options that we had in that adjustments menu from that we were talking about a little bit earlier. Most specifically, the first two are levels and curves. So I can actually create a new adjustment layer that modifies the levels or the curves without actually modifying the layer underneath it. And so let me show you what I mean by that. I'll go to curves again, and it's just giving me some information. It'll let me name the layer if I want to be able to organize it nicely. The rest you can pretty much leave alone. It's not going to be very important to us right now. So I hit OK, and then I'll be able to increase the contrast to that same ridiculous amount that I did before. Now click OK. Now it looks exactly the same as it did when we did this with just the levels tool before. But what's really neat is that you'll notice that down here in the layers palette, I have a new layer called curves. And it is modifying the layer underneath it. In fact, if you see the little icon right here, this looks like our original image. And in fact, if we hide this adjustment layer, we get that original image back. We see that it is still hidden underneath this adjustments layer. So we don't actually have to modify that one particular layer. And so this is where Photoshop's editing power really becomes apparent, is that now you can make these changes. And so if I wanted to make a change to the original image, and let's say that maybe I want to produce two versions of this image, one version that I want to have, you know, really ridiculous colors for, and another one where I just want to have mellow, more neutral colors. If I want to make a modification to this particular image, I can still make the modification here. So I could still do something. I'm just going to do something obnoxious like a doodle again. So just another cyan doodle here. Now, if I actually click on that, if I reappear that curves, then that modification still occurs within the curves. But I've made that modification to the original image. Now, what's really neat about this stuff, if we take it a step further than this, is that we can tell the layer to apply to only a specific portion of the image. So right now, it's being applied everywhere on this particular image. But let's say that I only wanted this ridiculous color maybe in this right half of the image, or maybe above this mountaintop, for example. Is there some way that I could modify that? And that is exactly what this little white box directly to the right of this adjustment layer icon is. This is called a mask. And using this mask, you can define which portions of that layer appear and which portions do not appear. So you have even finer grained control over the modifications that you can make to your image. And so another way to think of this mask is a way of defining transparency for that particular layer. So you'll notice that right now it is all white. And it is actually really important for me to note that if you're going to make a modification to a layer, you must click on that layer in this layers palette. So if I wanted to make the modification to the background, I have to click on the background or the curves layer. And that may sound obvious, but trust me, when you're making modifications and you realize that it's on the wrong layer or it's not behaving like you want it to, this is something that's very important to check, is that you're modifying the correct layer available. Okay, now one of the ways we can modify this particular mask is just to click it. And then we can actually use a brush. So over here, so along this confusing list of tools on the left side, one of them is a brush tool and it just looks like a brush. And so eventually you might learn some of these keyboard shortcuts. You notice that for a second it said in parentheses, it's a brush tool, and in parentheses it's the letter B. Eventually you might learn some of these shortcuts, but for now we'll just click on it. And then down here, we define the color of the brush. So we have a foreground color and a background color. For now, I'm going to use these little arrows to swap them so that now the black is the foreground color. So this means that using the brush tool, I'm just going to brush black onto something, any layer that I select. So now by clicking on this curves, and I should make the brush a little bit bigger. A lot of it bigger. All right, then I can actually modify specific portions of this image. And you might look at it, you might say that, well, I'm just making it a lot grayer, but that's how the original photo appeared. This was the original photo. This is the modified photo. But by using this mask, I can actually erase, so to speak, although I'm not really erasing, I can erase portions of this adjustment layer and modify it that way. Now you can actually view the adjustment layer and see your handiwork directly so that you don't have to see how it's actually impacting it. You can view the layer directly by Alt-clicking. So if you're on a Mac, it's the Option key. If you're on Windows, I believe it's the Alt key. It might be one of those keys down there. Just try them all if the Alt one doesn't work. When you alt-click on that, you will actually see the mask. So this is the painting that I did. It's very pretty, yes, but it's sort of an amorphous black blob that defines this mask. So whatever is black here means that the bottom layer is going to shine through. Whatever is white means that my current layer is going to be valid. So the adjustment that I made here will be valid everywhere that this mask is white, and it will be invalid, or it will allow the bottom layers to shine through unscathed, unmodified, through this black region here. Now the beauty of this is that it is not strictly black and white. You do have layers of gray available to you as well. And in fact, if I zoom in, you can see that it gets sort of soft here. There's these gray tones that exist here. And it is, you can use this to define a sort of a softer version or a less absolute form of this particular mask. And so you can use this mask to make it much, much softer. And using this, you can actually do it, so I'm not going to do the work now because I actually have already done the work elsewhere. You can use something like this to try to remove some particular image. Let's see. Okay, so here, this is embarrassing because apparently I used a different method altogether. What I attempted when I had this original image, and if you remember, this is just a processed image that I opened elsewhere. In the original image, if you ignore the doodle and the blob and the extra colors, it was that I had this annoying power line right through the image. And so one of the ways that I tried to change it was to use this concept of adjustment layers, so that you'll notice that I modified the brightness and the contrast of the image, made it a little bit brighter through that specific region of the image where it was actually made darker. and then used a mask here, and I'll zoom in on this, and you can see that I used the mask to try to define exactly where I wanted the brightness to be modified. Now, in the end, I have to admit that this didn't work out like I wanted it to, because it was very hard to get the edges of this sort of black line to look natural. It usually would get some sort of a halo effect, so I had to actually abort that particular mission and use an entirely different means of doing it, which I don't think we're going to go over today, but it's basically a way of just erasing things. So you can use this same technique. It's a clone stamp tool, and you can use it to erase all sorts of things, X's or, you know, people or things that you don't want in an image or what have you. You can actually do a pretty good job of erasing them. And I like to give myself a pat on the back for this one, because I think it's pretty hard to see where that particular power line went through. But the concept of this, of using this adjustment layer to actually modify specific regions of an image, is extremely powerful. And to give you a little bit more abstract of an idea, for those of you that have stalked my my Flickr account, may have noticed that one of the most recent things that I've done is actually taken some photos. And the motivation for this was that I have a computer connected to my TV, so that I could just watch some DVDs on it and what have you. And I was getting really bored with some of the wallpapers that existed there on it by default. And so I thought that I would try to combine not only both I wanted to combine the idea that it was a computer with the fact that it was on a TV. So I used the character from The Simpsons and actually added him to a variety of photos that existed in not only on default, by default with Mac OS, but also some photos that I have of my own. So this was that one photo that we saw, and you can see that Ralph is standing tall and he's a little bit sooty. And actually using these same concepts, was I able to accomplish this same sort of thing. So again, I'm using this as just an example of how you can use adjustment layers to be able to modify this. And it looks like this was so I didn't use many adjustment layers here, but I'll still show it to you so you can see what it looks like. You can actually use layering to try to add in additional elements or remove elements from photos and try to make it look as natural as possible, as if it actually belonged to that original image. And using masking, so let's see, Ralph mask. So I found a photo of Ralph somewhere. I think it was on the Ralph Wiggum for President website or something like that. And I just took this photo and just ended up masking it. So you can use the same sort of concept to select particular regions within a photo and then use that to actually form a select box. So typically you would use like this rectangular marquee tool over here and select something that's rectangular. But if you wanted to cut something out that has more shape to it, such as Ralph here, then what you can use is what's called quick mask mode. If you click on this icon that's just below the color selector, this is called the quick mask mode. You see that if I hover, it says edit in quick mask mode. If I click on that, what I can do is use like a brush, for example, and be able to select certain regions of Ralph. And so you can do this actually pretty quickly using brushes and then using progressively smaller brushes to highlight all of him. And then when you exit this quick mask mode, you'll notice that now it has selected particular regions of that image that I've selected. So it's the same masking concept, but now it's applying it in terms of a selection. So then you can copy this out and paste it into something that has just a plain white background, as was the case here. But if you notice, I actually have two layers on this particular mask, and if I remove the background, you'll notice that this sort of grid, this white and gray grid appears behind him. That's Photoshop's representation of a transparent background. So I have Ralph now, and he's pretty much transparent behind him. So all it takes is needing to take him and, you know, select all, edit, or no, it's under select, select all, and then edit, copy, and then you can just literally paste him somewhere else. And then, well, you'd have to resize him. He's a little big. But once you resize him, you can see that he's already transparent. So there's not a lot of work to be done here. I think one place where I actually did apply a mask, oops, was in this other one. So in this one, Ralph is looking over sort of the El Paso skyline that existed. Okay, so here he is. And once you paste him in, all right, you can see that I have a few layers here as well. Oh, good, this is excellent, because now we have a couple of adjustment layers. You can see that we have a hue saturation layer, color balance layer, brightness contrast layer. And the point of this was to bring this sort of cartoonish color that Ralph has and try to adjust it so that it looks more natural against the light that existed in the image. So if we just look at this example that I pasted here, you can see that it looks very cartoonish and the color appears incorrectly. But using adjustment layers with masking, you can apply corrective color and corrective saturation boosts or corrective contrast to that particular image. So if I remove this part, you can just delete a layer by clicking on the trash icon. Yes. Now I can see that here I adjusted the brightness and the contrast. So I thought he was a little too bright, not contrasty enough. So I decreased the brightness, increased the contrast, and so on and so forth for some of these other color balances. So I added a little bit more red because it was a sunset, and so there was this sort of warm light that was being cast across it. But after he was pasted in, all it took, and you can see that here, you can see that I have in this section, it's kind of hard to see, but you can see that Ralph exists in almost his entirety right here. Using a mask, you can just select which portions of him will actually be displayed. So in order to make him appear as though he were hiding behind the mountain, or that he was standing behind the mountain, you just apply a layer mask. So you once you paste him in, you apply a layer mask to him. And so I should show this to you because I've only showed you adjustment layers. So under the layer section, you can add a layer mask. Whoops. And so right now you can see that I have a couple of other options as well. All right, I'll just paste him in and show you how this is done properly. So I can do a layer mask, and I'll do a reveal all. And what that means is that the layer mask by default is going to show everything on this layer. If I did a hide all, then it will hide Ralph completely from this particular layer. And now you see that to this layer, I have added an all white mask. And so I can use a black brush again to just erase him, so to speak, from particular portions of this image. And it's not, and again, it's not actually erasing him. It's actually just removing or using a mask to hide specific portions of him. And then, you know, you can zoom in and do a better job along the mountaintops. But this is the general idea for a particular mask. And then using this same thing, you can basically just copy Ralph as he exists and apply the layer masks, or apply the adjustment layers, so that the adjustments only apply to him, as you can see in these particular cases. And so using all of this, all of these techniques, you can create an image that is as crazy and as goofy as Ralph with some of these photos. And in fact, if you're interested, I'll just do a short plug for my Flickr page, where I have almost all of these, or I think I do have all of them up. available, so you can see Ralph here in black and white. Oh, the one I'm really proud of. There's one that's I think is pretty neat. Where is he? Oh, the pier. No, is that the pier? Well, the pier's cool, because I put a little drop shadow. See? Okay, so there's a little shadow there. No, sea mist, I think. So you can use layering. You can use layering effects to just add some, and keep in mind that this doesn't take all that long. Well, once you know your way around some of these tools, it doesn't take all that long to be able to do this. But one of the things that I glossed over before when we were creating a new layer, when I was creating a new layer adjustment mask, was that I sort of glossed over a lot of these details, saying that most of this was just organizational. But one thing that's actually kind of handy sometimes is this mode select or the opacity select that you see here. So if you happen to already have a layer, you can modify the same information at the top of the layers palette. So you can see here it says normal and it says an opacity of 100%. And you'll notice that right here, there is, well, it's hard to see, but Ralph is here on layer 2. So by modifying the opacity, you can actually make something slightly less opaque. So maybe I want Ralph to be now only 50% opaque and make him look a little bit misty. But one of the neat things is being able to use something. So I will remove all this. You can use these other modes that exist for a layer to add some additional effects as well. So whereas before everything was normal, everything that we've seen up until this point had this normal layer effect, let's say that we wanted to add a little bit of fog to Ralph's feet. And we don't actually, it's hard to color match and it's hard to copy paste some of this information. So what you could do instead is you just remove Ralph temporarily, you select the background layer, and you just basically use this this rectangular marquee tool. You're just going to select a portion of the image, select a portion, copy it, and if you paste it, you'll notice that what happens is that I get a new layer. Now, it doesn't look any different. It's the same thing as before, and that's because it is put those pixels on top of the exact same place, so it's just going to appear the same as it did before. But if I remove these other layers from visibility, you can see that this is what I copy and pasted right there. Okay, now if I happen to have Ralph right here, you can see that if I rearrange the layers, that portion that I pasted is now on top of Ralph, so it's hiding him. It's not a mask really, but it's hiding him from that particular portion, and I can change the type of layer. So before it was a normal layer, but instead I just wanted to lighten Ralph. So I wanted to retain its color information and retain its look, but I just want to lighten him. I did it for the wrong one. All right, so this is what I mean when you have to select the correct layer. So now I've selected the layer that I pasted. If you click lighten and change its opacity to about 50%, you can see that now it's given him a sort of wispy look. And by using an eraser tool that's over here, I can erase it and try to make it into something of a fog-like appearance. So you can use a soft brush. So up here, when you define a brush, you generally want a sort of big brush, and you want to define the hardness down pretty much to zero, because then that gives you a very soft-looking brush like this versus a hard brush, which will be very harsh. And then it allows you to blend a lot of this information. So as you can see, it was just a five-minute thing to add Ralph and add this layer effect, though I did before a little bit harsher of a fog so that it was more apparent when modifying it. And you can see that the opacity was a little bit higher. It was a lightened thing, but still an opacity of 85%. And in fact, using these same tools, you can do all sorts of fun little things. And I think the last one that I'll show you, is it this one? All right, maybe I'll show you two more, because these are both, I think, pretty neat. Let's say that you want to add out-of-focus effects as well. So, yes, Photoshop has tons of filters that I argue are not very useful most of the time, but sometimes they do become kind of useful. So here, once you've pasted in Ralph, and you use a mask to hide him behind blades of glass like this, and you really can do this somewhat easily. Oops. So you can see that here I've just used a mask to paint over those blades of glass so that he hides behind it. Then what you can do is use a filter and a blur filter, more specifically like the Gaussian blur or the lens blur, to add a little bit of a blur to him and make him look like he's just out of the range of the depth of focus. So adding a slight blur, and you can see it's just compounding to the blur here, but it's the same sort of idea. And because when you apply a filter, you are applying it to a particular layer, you're not modifying the mask itself or the image underneath. So when you're applying this blur, when you have separated out all of these components into this sort of separate thing, then you can apply additional blur without modifying anything else. It's still, if you were to apply it everywhere, then of course everything would look blurrier, or everything would look just a little bit, or rather, everything would look blurrier, or you would also get a blurrier line between where Ralph should exist on this particular image. And so, as a finale, I think I'll show you this one, where he is actually inside of a dewdrop. Oops. And this I thought would be the hardest one to accomplish, but it actually ended up being one of the easiest ones. And it uses the same sort of idea from that fog one, but basically you paste in Ralph and you align him nicely with the dewdrop. And keep in mind that these images are the ones, they're not mine, they're the ones that come by default with for the wallpaper for OS X. I just thought it would be fun to manipulate them. Then you use that same sort of idea before, where you take and you select that particular dewdrop, you copy it. Oops, no, copy merged. Select the correct layer first, copy it, paste it, put it at the very top as the top layer. Now if I show Ralph, I can see that he's here. Now if I show that layer that I just pasted, you can see that it hides him completely. But I can change the opacity slightly. So now I can see, okay, well, it's probably too much. But now this doesn't still look quite right. It's sort of getting there, but now using the same sort of idea before, where we change the mode of this particular layer to lighten, what that means is that everywhere that this particular layer, and this layer is the dewdrop that I just pasted there, everywhere it is lighter, it will make the layers underneath lighter as well. So just by clicking on lighten, now I can get something that appears, I can get something that appears to be just like Ralph is inside of that dewdrop, because now this part is much lighter than him, and so it covers him completely, and Photoshop does all of the hard work. There's not a lot of really complicated masking or color correcting going on here. It's literally just two additional layers on top of this one photo to get this sort of effect. Okay, so that's it for software tools, and I hope that now with these things you will be able to go home and have even more creativity flowing from your fingertips, so to speak, and into your computer. Next week, I actually won't be here, but John will be leading the assignment slideshow, which is actually a really interesting way of viewing each other's images as we get to talk about them. Unfortunately, it will not be taped, so if you are planning on not being here, you will miss it. So do be here, please. It will be very interesting, I promise. Then the latter half is actually a movie night, which is a very interesting documentary on National Geographic photographers, where if you are serious about photography at all, I know you've thought about it, that you want to get your photos published, and it's a really interesting look sort of behind the scenes of that. And with that, thank you very much, and I will see you in a couple of weeks.